Truth Seekers. Mike Malloy here. Thanks for tuning in. It's about 7 past the hour as we start the haul for tonight, right? We, Kathy and I, were watching on Saturday night. Molly had a sleepover, so we have the fire going in the fireplace and the TV on, and we're watching, I don't know, some, what was it, On the Town or something on Turner Classic Movies, Gene Kelly, Frank Sinatra, I think that's what it was, about three sailors, and the movie ended and we flipped over to MSNBC just to see what was going on, and they're talking about the death of Whitney Houston, which was a shocking segue. I don't think anyone who followed her career outside of singing was terribly surprised. I hate to say that, but anyway, so we, you know, we talked about it for a while. Both Kathy and I like her music, have since the late 80s, 90s. I loved her singing. Thought she was a very intense and yet melodic star. So we talked about it for a couple of minutes, and then, you know, what are you going to say? It wasn't family. It wasn't a friend. It wasn't an acquaintance who had died. It was a pop star, a cultural star. So, I mean, there's not a whole lot that you can, you know, that you can talk about a person like that dying, except for the fact that she was so young, and except for the fact that she was on a trajectory, some will say, and I don't disagree, that started when she hooked up with Bobby Brown. And again, the only reason I know that is because so much of their melodrama played out here in the Atlanta area, court cases and so on and so forth. So it was hard to escape in the middle of this decade just passed. Anyway, so like everybody else, we went through the weekend with the endless tributes to her. Sunday night I did watch on NBC, what's his name, from Chicago, who now MCs the or not MC, but he's the anchor on Sunday night. You're drawing a blank too? Lester Holt. Oh, God. Lester Holt had a special right after the newscast Sunday night. We watched that, or I watched that. And it was touching, it was moving, and that's the end of it. Today, I happened to be listening to MSNBC when the L.A. coroner came out to give a non-progress report about what had been discovered in the initial findings of the autopsy. And I listened for a while on Sirius, listening to MSNBC on Sirius Radio in the car. And sure enough, as soon as he finished his comments, it started again. That horrible cacophony of these cawing, screaming, ripping entertainment reporters. I have to assume that's where they were, who they were. With the kind of belligerent, nasty, ugly, probing questions that you would think people would have the decency not to ask. I mean, who gives a goddamn to these, for these people? I just, you know, I wanted to say to these slugs who were harassing this DA, why don't you, or this coroner, why don't you just sit down and shut up, you filthy maggots? You'll have your answers soon enough. Now, granted, this is no Michael Jackson event, but don't you get tired of that? Don't you get sick of that? And when you hear the screaming, you know, I wonder why reporters don't do the same when John Boehner or some of these other Republican Nazis are standing out there giving one of their lying, filthy press conferences. Why don't these people scream at Newt Gingrich like that? I know. It's a different kind of situation. I understand that. But still, the thought, that thought crossed my mind. But as I listened to the scum screaming, and I mean the sounds of their voices is just it's just like fingers down a chalkboard. It's just horrible. Just horrible, you know. And I was thinking to myself, Jesus Christ, why don't you people just go? I don't know. Go do something else. Go dig graves. So later on, you know, it starts to fade immediately because it is someone's death, and unless it is part of your family or a deep personal friend, it starts to fade rather quickly, doesn't it? So I get this email this afternoon from Yuri in Vancouver, British Columbia, and he writes, Mike, perhaps you thought the overwrought media coverage of Michael Jackson's death was an aberration. Apparently it was not. Up until yesterday, and except for the tabloid rags, the mainstream press couldn't care less about Whitney Houston and her travails. But now that she's dead, they're clamoring to outdo each other with gaudy tributes and sniffing after scandal. Why is this so? I think I have the answer, Yuri writes. We in the West belong to a death cult dressed up as culture. Ever wonder why the word culture begins with cult? The derivation is from the Latin cultus, to adore, worship, venerate. By some definitions, a cult is a religion that lacks political power. Thanks to Emperor Constantine, a fringe corpse-worshipping death cult rose from obscurity to become the predominant religion of Western civilization and the major force in our present-day culture and politics. The major underpinning of this former cult is that the Christ died for our sins. Our children must therefore wear depictions of Christ's mutilated corpse upon their necklaces, and we must kneel before identically gruesome icons above church altars. Let us put aside that this cornerstone of Christianity is itself a blatant contradiction. Since Jesus is supposedly a god, and since gods are immortal, Jesus cannot have died. If the Gospels are to be believed, Christ is back in heaven, sitting on the right hand of the Father deity. How is that dying? For by what measure is that a sacrifice? But I digress. For the next several days, perhaps for weeks, the high priests in media will put on a frenzied, orgiastic death-fetishing mass as they discover, savor, and then discard every tragic and salacious detail of this talented but troubled woman's life. In the meantime, reporting of the manifold and profound problems of this world will take a back seat. Hallelujah. Yuri in Vancouver. Yeah. Okay, so he did go off on a tangent there about Constantine and the death cult. But I thought that, yeah, that pretty much puts a lid on it for me. I like Whitney Houston's music. Some of it was very moving to me. I just love it. You know, I've got that romantic aspect. And the old Dolly Parton song that she did, that Whitney Houston, has just got to be one of my favorite pieces of music. And I have to tell you, was it the 1991 Super Bowl when Whitney Houston sang the Star Spangled Banner? That, well, I was going to say it became my favorite rendition of that, but that my favorite still remains Jimi Hendrix's rendition. But Whitney Houston's became the favorite that was played straight and, you know, without all the violent pregnancy that was evident in Jimi Hendrix. So that's all. I'm not going to talk about it or dwell on it. I thought she was a great entertainer and a great singer. And it's just sad that drugs and alcohol, if that's how it turns out, once again take somebody away.
right here, right now, Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. Prairie 2 had sent me this last Friday, and I didn't get around to it, and I want to get on it now. Remember last week the Obama administration announced a 25, well, not the administration, but the Justice Department, well, that's part of it, a $25 billion settlement with five of the most predatory, vicious examples of capitalist exploitation in the history of the human race. Those would be those five banks that we've all heard so much about. $25 billion, and I made the comment that that was kind of chump change. Bruce writes, $25 billion sounds like a lot of money, but when you consider that there are individuals who could write a check for that amount, it's not that much. Compared to the $150 billion in bonuses that Wall Street bankers take each year, it's really not that much at all. Compared to the trillions in economic damage done by this grand conspiracy, $25 billion is a rounding error. Compared to the 4 million people who have lost their homes so far due to the fraud of the Bush crime family, it works out to $6,000 each, enough to pay for a used car to live in. And really, those people are only eligible for $1,500 each, so it's just gas money for the house. The rest goes to write down mortgages, which means the money really goes to, wait for it, the banks. The good news is that thanks to some of the state attorneys general holding out on the settlement, the immunity deal the banks got only applies to the illegal robo-signing scheme. Homeowners can, in theory, still sue for damages. Robo-signing was the practice of generating phony mortgage documents and hiring someone at minimum wage to sign and notarize them as if they were a bank vice president. In the time it takes to scrawl the signature, they claim to have carefully examined the real, non-existent mortgage and certified that they had attempted to settle with the homeowner. Often the homeowner or rightful owner would be making reduced payments agreed to by a real bank representative and still receive a foreclosure from one of these document mills. The banks and the criminals who run them are still open to charges of securities fraud, stock fraud, bank fraud, tax fraud, wire fraud, and any other felonies that the attorneys general can come up with. Obama promised an investigation in his State of the Union speech. Donations to his reelection from Wall Street have been notably absent. Some would say cynically that Obama's super PAC will just get the money with no disclosure, maybe. But the alternative is having Mitt Romney, who would speed up the foreclosure process and put the houses in the hands of investors, as he said. Andrew Mellon, Secretary of the Treasury for all the Republican presidents in the 1920s, and one of the richest men to ever have lived, famously advised Hoover to, quote, liquidate labor, liquidate stocks, liquidate the farmers, liquidate real estate, end quote. He also said, quote, in a depression, assets return to their rightful owners, end quote. The Mellon apologists assert that Hoover didn't follow Mellon's advice, and this caused the Great Depression. Right-wingers seem to have difficulty measuring the passage of time. Mellon was giving this advice because the Depression was already raging unabated. Of course, they often claim the Depression didn't really start until well into Roosevelt's presidency, much as the Garden of Eden existed until the day Obama was sworn in. The International Monetary Fund is fond of Mellon's liquidation doctrine and has employed it many times in third world countries. Greece is currently being liquidated in just that manner as we speak. The political right constantly screams that we are destined to become Greece because of our welfare state and obscene way we give, this obscene pay we give teachers' unions. They can't wait to return all the assets to their rightful owners. PrairieNumeral2.com is his website. You can always also find his essays at TV News Lies www.mikemalone.org. And in regards to that, the top 1%, I got this in the mail today, slow mail, top 1% now owns 34% of everything, ponds, streams, wealth, income. The next 4% owns 26.6% of everything. Call it 27, so now we're at 34, 44, 54, 61%. The top 5% owns 61% of everything. The next 5% owns another 11% of everything. So now we're at 75%, almost, owned by the top 10%. The next 40% owns 26% of everything. And the bottom 50% owns 2.5% of everything. Did you get that? Did you understand that? If you're in the bottom 50%, you and I and everybody else, our total ownership of everything, 2.5%.
Revolution starts right now. Here's Mike Malone.
Twenty-five before the hour. There was some voting over the weekend, right? Was there voting? There was a Maine primary, I think. Yeah, I'm sorry. I just find the whole thing weirdly amusing. Oh, I know we were watching. We were watching Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas when we switched over and got the news of Whitney Houston's death. At reader-supported news, there's a notice there from Robert Redford asking people to sign a petition over the next 24 hours to try to stop the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline. You can participate in this if you go to stoptar.org, stoptar.org. And if you do it, turn off the volume then and send it to everyone you know. Tweet it, Facebook it, blog it, whatever. StopTar.org. He makes a point. If we don't do something, he said this do-nothing option is the same flawed recommendation that economists made in the 60s and 70s to the automobile industry. Imagine something like seatbelts being seen as a job killer of that day. It's so maddeningly ridiculous in this country, isn't it? I mean, it really is. StopTar.org. Alex in New York City sent me something that's kind of chilling when you get right down to it. It's from the Washington Post, Greg Sargent's Plumline. The Post just released some new polling that demonstrates very strong support for Obama's counterterrorism policies, including 83% of Americans approving of his use of drone strikes against so-called terror suspects overseas, right? This finding, the one I'm going to share with you, though, is particularly startling. Here was the question. What if those suspected terrorists are American citizens living in other countries? In that case, do you approve or disapprove of the use of drones? Approve? 65%. Disapprove? 26%. So, to me, the key word in that is the word suspected. What of those suspected terrorists or American citizens? Do you still support the idea of assassinating them with drone strikes? 65% of Americans in this survey approved. Now, the number of those who approve of the drone strikes drops nearly 20% when the respondents are told that the targets are American citizens. So it goes from 83% down to 65%. But still, don't you think that 65% is a pretty big number? I mean, given that these policies really are controversial, as they should be. Oh, my God. I just don't believe it. And get this. Democrats approve of the drone strikes on American citizens by a 58-33. 58% say, oh, get them, kill them. 33% no. And even liberals approve of them, drone strikes. 55% of liberals say yes. 35% say no. It's hard to imagine Democrats and liberals approving this if it would have been a Bush idea, right? Now, as the Post says, the American Civil Liberties Union has filed a lawsuit against the Obama administration over its refusal to release information regarding the drone strike program. The lawsuit demands documents detailing the legal rationale for the fact that, quote, media reports revealed that at least three American citizens have been killed over the last 4 months by unmanned aerial vehicles on the basis of unilateral decisions made by the executive branch, end quote. And as Glenn Greenwald has been pointing out at Salon, the Obama administration has responded to this ACLU lawsuit with the Orwellian argument that they can't honor the ACLU's request because even the answer to the question of whether such documents exist is classified information. Oh, my God. But as the polling demonstrates, the reality is here that the Obama administration doesn't have to worry about public opinion on these questions at all. Nope. If the executive branch of this government, and Obama's in charge now, who knows who's going to be in charge next year or 5 years from now, but he's in charge now. So anytime the Obama administration makes a decision to execute somebody, blow them to pieces with a Hellfire missile released from a drone aircraft, it's just done. And it doesn't make any difference what the evidence in it, what the evidence against this person is, apparently. It can't be challenged in court. It can't be challenged anywhere. So, I mean, if the evidence is contrived or trumped up or false or fake or somebody trying to even a score or get rid of somebody, who's to know? Is this the way it's supposed to work? All of which is to say that the cause of defending the rights of suspected terrorists, even if they're Americans, isn't a very popular idea. What happens when the terrorists, as they are defined by the executive branch of whoever's government, what happens when those terrorists are walking here? Knox Ewers is the sponsor of this first hour. His message, have I mentioned yet tonight how much I love these people? Long live the Malloys, Mike, Kathy, and Molly. Well, that's very kind. Thanks, Knox. What else here? I don't know. I have to let that sink in for a second. How do we get to that point where the majority, simple majority of Americans, simple majority of Democrats, simple majority of liberals say, kill them? American citizens who are suspected. Pretty scary stuff. Pretty scary stuff indeed. What else we got tonight? Anything? Are the Republicans still talking about Reagan and about all the wonderful things that, you know, in those golden, glorious years of the first 8 years of the 80s? Anybody still talk? I don't know. Do they still talk about it? What was it? A couple of weeks ago was the 100th birthday of Ronald Reagan. 100th anniversary of his birth, I should put it that way. And having participated in some forums with Ron Reagan Jr., I have to tell you that, you know, he loved his dad. And he came out with a book, Reagan at 100, I believe. And it was kind of a family, although there was some political stuff in it. You remember a few months ago? I don't know Ron Reagan Jr. that well, but in the times I've spent with him, usually in a public forum, sometimes, you know, back in the so-called green room, having a piece of watermelon or something before we went out on the stage, I found him to be just a nice guy. Just a really nice man. And usually in those conversations, Hartman might be there and Stephanie Miller might be there. And it's interesting how the conversation stays away from his dad's policies. And I guess that's the way it should be. Just out of respect. The sins of the father, so on and so forth, shouldn't be visited upon the children, right? But they're the sons. But so many things have been said about Reagan that are just not true. Simply not true. Not by his son, not by Ron Reagan Jr. I mean, he doesn't really get into that aspect. But these filthy Republicans do constantly. So when we come back after this break, just a couple of points to make about the Reagan presidency. Stay with us.
It just ain't the same. Always been changed. New days are strange. Is the world insane? If love and peace is so strong, why are the pieces of love that don't belong? Nations dropping bombs. Chemical gases filling lungs of little ones with ongoing suffering. As the youth are young, so ask yourself, is the loving really gone? So I could ask myself, really what is going wrong in this world that we living in? People keep on giving in, making wrong decisions, only visions of the negative. Not respecting each other, denying thy brother. A war's going on, but the reason's undercover. The truth is kept secret, it's swept under the rug. If you never know truth, then you never know love. What's the love, yo? Come on,
I don't know.
Where's the truth?
Come 50,000 watts of free speech. It's Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. Ronald Reagan. The the analysts back in the day predicted that Reagan's massive $800 billion supply-side tax cuts in 1981. See, it wasn't just Bush. It wasn't, you know, they do this all the time. But those tax cuts would produce massive annual budget deficits. And sure enough, combined with his rapid increase in defense spending or offense spending, Reagan delivered not the balanced budgets he promised, but deficits, record-setting deficits. Forced to raise taxes twice to avert financial catastrophe, Reagan nonetheless presided over a tripling of the American national debt to nearly $3 trillion. It took 200 years of history to get to $1 trillion. That would be when Reagan was elected. And by the time he left, he had tripled it to $3 trillion. So Reagan tripled the national debt. That's the first chink in the armor. Regardless of this freak Sarah Palin's revisionist history, it was Reagan who put the United States on the so-called road to ruin. Reagan raised taxes 11 times. 11 times. As a former Republican senator, that crazy Alan Simpson, who called Reagan a dear friend, told NPR recently, quote, Ronald Reagan raised taxes 11 times in his administration. I was there. And it's also worth noting that it was President Obama and not President Reagan who delivered the largest two-year tax cut in American history, but never mind. Reagan expanded the size of government. You hear these Republican scum saying, we need to stop spending and cut government back down to size. Well, if that's the case, then the role model should be Bill Clinton, maybe, but certainly not Ronald Reagan. As USA Today pointed out years ago, measured as a percentage of gross domestic product, average annual federal spending dropped far more under Bill Clinton than Ronald Reagan. Well, these are facts, and facts are not the that's not the currency that Republicans deal with. Reagan supported the so-called socialist earned income tax credit. Now, during and after the 2008 presidential campaign, these Republican scum and Republican commentators blasted Obama's proposals to offer Americans expanded tax credits. They called it socialism, welfare. If they really mean that, they should have been directing, or should today, their anger toward Ronald Reagan. Well, virtually all working Americans pay the Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare payroll taxes. Many don't pay federal income tax thanks to the earned income tax credit. And as the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities noted in 2005, the earned income tax credit was not only very successful in lowering poverty, it has enjoyed substantial bipartisan support. President Reagan, President George Herbert Walker Bush, President Clinton all praised it and proposed expansions in it. But if you listen to the Republicans even today, oh, the earned income tax credit? Oh, that's a socialist trick. Reagan negotiated with the terrorists in Tehran. Obama has been criticized as being weak on Iran. And back in December, it was said that Ronald Reagan once denounced an evil empire and looked toward a time when communism was left on the ash heap of history. Blah, blah, blah. This would be the same Ronald Reagan whose policy consisted of giving the mullahs in Iran a cake, a Bible, and U.S. TOW missiles. Remember that? The Iran-Contra scandal? Huh? Look it up. I'm not going to get into it tonight. You can look it up. Reagan sought to eliminate nuclear weapons. How about that? In late 2010, Republicans opposed Obama's new START treaty, calling for joint reductions in the American-Russian nuclear stockpiles. But guess what, truth seekers? It was Reagan, not Obama, who declared, quote, my dream, become a world free of nuclear weapons. Reagan said that. Number seven, Reagan gave amnesty to millions of illegal immigrants. Reagan signed a law into law a bill that made any immigrant who had entered the country before 1982 illegally eligible for amnesty. The bill was sold as a crackdown, but its sanctions on employers who hired undocumented immigrants were removed before final passage. The bill helped 3 million people and millions more family members gain American residency. It has since become a source of major embarrassment for conservatives. Oh, yeah. Reagan signed abortion rights law in California. As governor of California in 1967, Reagan signed a bill to liberalize the state's abortion laws that, quote, resulted in more than a million abortions, end quote. It just goes on and on. So, you know, if you're ever listening to one of these scum suckers up close, by scum sucker, I mean these filthy, degenerate, drooling Republican devils, and they're talking about the glorious good old days of Ronald Reagan, point some of this stuff out to them. Huh? Let them know that you're on to their trickery, treachery, lickery, lechery. We'll be back after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Alexander sent this to me the other day. I'm just getting around to it. By the way, next hour, we have 10 steps toward radical revolution in the United States. Stick around for that. Derek Jensen is an author and environmental activist. He lives in California, Crescent City. He's got several books out there circulating that question and critique modern civilization. He's the one that wrote Endgame. He also wrote The Culture of Make-Believe. He has a bachelor's degree in mineral engineering physics and a master of fine arts in creative writing from Eastern Washington University. He has taught creative writing at Pelican Bay State Penitentiary and East Washington University. And I want to share this with you. This is worth reading or listening to. Oh, and by the way, you can get this at Bob Alexander's website, superbeans.com. Superbeans.com. It's a new declaration. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that the real physical world is the source of our own lives and the lives of others. A weakened planet is less capable of supporting life, human or otherwise. Thus, the health of the real world is primary, more important than any social or economic system, because all social or economic systems are dependent upon a living planet. We hold this truth to be self-evident, that to value a social system that harms the planet's capacity to support life over life itself is to be out of touch with physical reality. That any way of life based on the use of non-renewable resources is by definition not sustainable. That any way of life based on the hyper-exploitation of renewable resources is by definition not sustainable. If, for example, fewer salmon return every year, eventually there will be none This means that for a way of life to be sustainable, it must not harm native communities, native prairies, native forests, native fisheries, and so on. We hold this truth to be self-evident, that the real world is interdependent, such that harm done to rivers harms those humans and non-humans whose lives depend on these rivers. Harms forests and prairies and wetlands surrounding these rivers. Harms the oceans into which these rivers flow. Harm done to mountains harms the rivers flowing through them. Harm done to oceans harms everyone directly or indirectly connected to them. We hold this truth to be self-evident, that you cannot argue with physics. If you burn carbon-based fuels, this carbon will go into the air and have effects in the real world. That creating and releasing poisons into the world will poison humans and non-humans. That no one, no matter how rich or powerful, should be allowed to create poisons for which there is no antidote. That no one, no matter how rich or powerful, should be allowed to create messes that cannot be cleaned up. That no one, no matter how rich or powerful, should be allowed to destroy places humans or non-humans need to survive. That no one, no matter how rich or powerful, should be allowed to drive human culture or non-human species extinct. We hold this truth to be self-evident, that reality trumps all belief systems. What you believe is not nearly so important as what is real. That on a finite planet, you cannot have an economy based on or requiring growth. At least you cannot have one and expect to either have a planet or a future. That the current way of life is not sustainable and will collapse. The only real questions are what will be left of the world after that collapse. And how bad things will be for the humans and non-humans who come after. We hold it as self-evident that we should do all we can to make sure that as much of the real physical world remains intact until the collapse of the current system, and that humans and non-humans should be as prepared as possible for this collapse. We hold this truth to be self-evident, that the health of local economies are more important than the health of a global economy, that a global economy should not be allowed to harm local economies or land bases, that corporations are not living beings. They're certainly not human beings. That corporations do not in any real sense exist. That the health of human and non-human communities is more important than the profits of corporations. We hold it as self-evident, as the Declaration of Independence states, quote, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of the ends of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it. End quote. Further, we hold it as self-evident that it would be more precise to say that it is not the right of the people, nor even the responsibility, but it says something more like breathing, something that if we fail to do, we die. If we as a people fail to rid our communities of destructive institutions, those institutions will destroy our communities. And if we, in our communities, cannot provide meaningful and non-destructive ways for people to gain food, clothing, and shelter, then we must recognize it's not just specific destructive institutions, but the entire economic system that is pushing the natural world past breaking points. Capitalism is killing the planet. Industrial civilization is killing the planet. Once we've recognized the destructiveness of capitalism and industrial civilization, both of which are based on systematically converting a living planet into dead commodities, once we've recognized this, we've no choice. Unless we wish to sign our own and our children's death warrants, no choice but to fight for all we're worth, and in every way, we can overturn it. And as Bob adds at the end, that neatly sums it up, doesn't it? Yes, it really does. I sometimes wonder, I really do, I wonder why the great liberal commentators and pundits that you will find scattered hither and yon across the dial, radio and television, why there is no coordinated, concentrated effort to educate people, we people, educate us people, I should say, educate us and whatever members of the global community want to listen, that capitalism equals death. I've never been able to understand that. I realize that capitalism keeps a lot of the liberal commentators going, and they dare not bite the hand that puts them to sleep. But it's like Derek Jensen wrote here. I mean, at some point, doesn't survival trump all this other crapola? I mean, doesn't it? I know what it is. People just don't believe that survival is an issue. Nah. That's the problem. As Bob Alexander and others have written many times, denial and avoidance and pretending like things are okay is a way of not surviving, is a way of avoiding something. I don't think I mentioned the third time, Kathy, that the first hour was sponsored by Knox Ewers. And he has a message. Have I mentioned yet tonight how much I love these people? Long live the Malloys, Mike, Kathy, and Molly. Thanks, Knox. Phones are open if you want to comment on something. 877-996-2556. You notice how I say comment on something. Here in Atlanta, more or less, well, we're not actually in Atlanta, but might as well be, 13 people were arrested inside the lobby of the AT&T building it's today. Yeah. I saw the video and I thought, wait a minute. The group said they would sit in the lobby until AT&T promised not to lay off 740 union workers across the southeastern United States. They sang several songs in which they changed the lyrics. One of these was, AT&T, don't stoop so low and let these workers go. We all know you made record profits last year. AT&T, please hear our cries. We're here to ask you why you cut jobs and don't even shed a tear. Your CEO makes millions of dollars each year while 700 workers are living in fear that they will lose their jobs and not be able to pay their bills. Help us if you will. We all know you made record profits last year. End quote. One of the people who was there, who got arrested, is a guy named Will Marshall. And he told Atlanta Progressive News his reason for being arrested. He said, quote, I'm a small business owner, and when American workers lose their jobs, they can't afford to get a haircut. This hurts my barber shop and other small business owners, end quote. A woman named Arlene Jones Owens of Carrollton, Georgia, said she was willing to get arrested because, quote, I am here as an American in support of American jobs. AT&T should not lay off anybody with their record profits. Americans need full-time employment, not part-time without benefits. So, Occupy Atlanta, 13 arrested. Today. There's a mass mobilization planned for tomorrow, Valentine's Day, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. If you're in the metro Atlanta area in front of AT&T's building at 675 West Peachtree Street. Tomorrow, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Where are we? Here we are. Susan is in Squim, Washington. Hello, Susan.
Hi, Mike. How are you tonight?
I understand your governor signed a law today so that Washington becomes, what, the seventh state to recognize the Constitution's equal protection.
Yes, she did.
Segment.
And there was a big ceremony in Olympia, and Rick Santorum tried to upstage the whole thing by coming, doing some campaigning in state today and meeting with Republicans down in Olympia. And then he had a big rally in Tacoma, but he didn't dare come to Seattle.
Well, that's nice of Rick to show his interest in what's going on in Washington state politics. Yeah.
Well, I'm a little concerned about something that's going on in Washington State. In fact, in the whole Pacific Northwest area, along our oceans, and that is, I just found out some of the facts about fish farming that are just shocking to me. Shocking.
No, it's not very nice business.
Well, I did not realize exactly what goes on with this. What they're doing in Puget Sound, which is, at one time was a very pristine area, and there's a lot of people depending, especially Native Americans, on their fishing, on fishing in that area. And so it's one that we need to preserve. And they're taking these huge cages and putting them out in the sound and cramming fish in them. And then they're growing on land grains and, the main thing that they make everything out of now, whatchamacallit. And they're putting a lot of fertilizer and a lot of chemicals in it. And
high fructose corn syrup? Soy product?
Soy, mainly soy, and other grains. And then they're putting a lot of antibiotics. They're using more antibiotics in fish farming than in any other kind of livestock. And they're throwing this all in these cages. And the fish in...
Susan, can you hold on a second?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, let me put you on hold because... all of a sudden, we got a break here. I want to hear the rest of this. Stick around. The number here, if you want to join in, 877-996-2556. I'm Mike Malloy.
To the flying monkey right, it's Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour, back to Susan in Squim, Washington. Now, the horror of these of fish farming.
Well, it's really way worse than I thought, the extent of this. For example, in the sound, in Puget Sound alone, which is not all that big as far as bodies of water go, there's so many fish being farmed in there now that the excrement that they're putting into the ocean is 10 million tons a year.
Jesus.
And what it's doing, of course, is because it's so concentrated, it's poisoning the bottom. And there's all kinds of algae and stuff forming. And the fish are not as high in nutrition as wild fish. And the wild fish are getting into this mess. And now they're wanting to expand it. And they're wanting to expand it up into the Strait of Juan de Fuca and down the West Coast, all the way down through Oregon. They're wanting to grow. What it's doing is it's putting toxins on the land because they want to grow this soy, this high-yield soy that is a Monsanto hybrid GMO grain and other grains, and then they want to dump that in the ocean. And so they're poisoning everything all at once. It's just shocking to think that they're being allowed to get away with all this, and we're having no way to fight it.
Now, who are the industries in? I guess it's a Washington-based industry of companies.
No, they're coming in from the West, big farm industries, and they're big corporate. It's all corporate. It's all big corporate fish farms from other countries and from the West and the Midwest, and then the local farmers are worried because we have a lot of organic farming going on here, and we don't want to contaminate our crops.
Well,
we have a lot of mom and pop small business farms that are doing very well.
Are you familiar with the virus that got into the farmed? I believe it was salmon. I think off the coast of Ecuador. I think it was Ecuador.
Yes, this is something that they're talking about here. I was listening to the public local talk show, progressive talk show out of Bellingham, and they had some people on that were really, really frightened. I mean, they were trying to fight it. Native groups are trying to fight it. The problem is, and this brings it all around to what you were saying about helping the planet and trying to be good monitors of this planet. Right now, the Obama administration has a record with the environment that is shockingly lacking.
Yeah.
It's worse than Bush's.
That's putting it mildly, too.
It is putting it mildly.
You know he's going to somehow sign off on the Keystone XL pipeline. You know that's going
to
happen.
Well, yeah, now it's back in the Senate again. Everybody's all freaked out about that. And he will sign it if they pass it. I know that.
Yeah.
And this is what it brings it all around to me. You know how fed up we've been with this voting for the lesser of evils things? You know, if we just stopped doing that about 10 or 15 years ago, maybe we would have had a really viable Green Party by now.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the Republican Party would be dead. It belongs in the dustbin of history. It's obviously obsolete. My goodness, you know they're not trying to win the presidency. They're running nothing but nut jobs.
Right.
Maybe we should start working to try to. I know that Jill Stein is not a viable candidate for president, but she's actually very qualified, and the Green Party platform is really good. It's not out there. It's not crazy. It's what most people want for the country. And I think if we start working for people to get elected at local and state and maybe even Congress, maybe we can, when the Republican Party dies, we need to have another party. Let's make sure it's left of the Democrats and not right.
That's a good idea. All right, Susan, thanks. I'm glad you called. Thanks for that information.
Okay, thanks, Mike.
All right, take care. Yeah, the fish farming thing. One thing that I wanted to add to what she said, before the Republican Party is cast onto the dust heap of history, it has to be stabbed and tortured and have its hands and feet cut off and its brain caved in. It has to be beaten and beaten and beaten to make sure it never comes back again. So, yeah, then the dust heap or dust bin of history Fish farming. First of all, we stopped buying salmon for a while until I got an email from someone off the coast or in Alaska who said that it's okay to buy salmon. I'm not even sure anymore. But as far as farmed fish of any kind, especially salmon, I wouldn't touch it with, I don't want to come near it. I knew that the farming techniques were vile and filthy and promoted disease, not health. But I had no idea that in order to, what makes the flesh of a salmon pink? It's the creatures that the salmon eats. Shrimp, little tiny creatures that have that pigmentation. Now, in a fish farm, of course, they don't get that. They have a diet that is not what they normally would eat. So they're fattened up, as Susan pointed out, of course. This is true in the beef industry, the pork industry, tons and tons and tons of antibiotics because that adds weight. But with the salmon, what they do is inject the fish with a sort of dye in order to give it the pink color. So that when it goes to market, now if you want to see that it looks like normal fish, which it isn't. If you want to see something really horrifying, go to one of your big supermarkets. Here in the East, we have Kroger, we have Publix, we have, I don't know, there's a couple more. Who is there besides Kroger and Publix, Kathy?
Piggly Wiggly.
Piggly Wiggly? Is that still big here in the Southeast? But go into one of those stores.
Trader Joe's?
No, not Trader Joe's. They don't sell farmed fish, do they? I don't even know. But go into one of these huge supermarkets. Go back to the seafood section where the display case is, and the phony lights up underneath there. They're not fluorescent. They're something else. And take a look at the salmon fillets. And it says, there's a law that says it has to say if it's wild or farmed. And take a look at the farmed salmon at this pink color. It's a color that is not found anywhere in nature. But you can stand there, if you don't get arrested, stand there and watch people come up and buy that garbage. And the salmon that they're buying, it would probably be sort of a sullen gray, the color of something dead, but not this salmon. It's all pink. Did you know that? Terrible stuff. Ray is in Oakdale, Minnesota, listening on KTNF. Hello, Ray.
Hey, Michael, how are you? It's been a while.
Yeah, it has. How you been?
Yeah. Well, I'll try to be as succinct as possible.
Okay.
I told your screener, I don't know whether it was your Kathy or not.
It was. Yeah, it was.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, thank goddess for the firm of Malloy, Malloy, and Malloy. And I hope your little one meets my grandnephew in college someday.
I hope so, too.
But anyway, I heard a program from Canada tonight called As It Happens.
As It Happens?
Yeah, I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I am not.
But they interviewed this horrible, horrible excuse for a human being. She's the chief economic advisor for the Greek government, and she was singing the praises of Margaret Thatcher and saying that the Greek people are simply going to have to hunker down and suffer for the indefinite future.
Mm-hmm.
I called her names, Mike, that haven't been invented yet.
Yeah, we're watching Greece being utterly and absolutely destroyed. I hope the Greek people
rise up.
Will continue to resist. It's horrifying to watch a country as ancient as Greece being destroyed by these money-grubbing bastards who are pulling the trapdoor underneath their feet and expecting Greece to swing by the neck. It's just unbelievable.
Well, Mike, I'm really hoping to, number one, send you a series of emails in the next days. I'm asking your listeners to go to our website, kalpuli.net. You know that I'm founder and director of Kalpuli Turtle Island Multiversity.
Right, K-A-L-P-U-L-L-I.
Good name. Mike, you're incredible.
Kalpuli. I've got it written down here. Kalpuli.net. All right.
Yes, and I want hits, and I want to start having conversations. As I told you, Kathy, we need a world revolution, and...
That is very true. As a matter of fact, next hour, Ray, I'm going to talk about just that. Hey, listen, I've got to leave it there. Thanks, pal. I appreciate your checking in.
I thought I was playing a song about fish.
New York, New York. I want to wake up in a city that doesn't sleep and find I'm king of the hill, top of the heap.
94 the hour. No, I don't know why that was. That's right. I like that song. That's a good song. Who do we have here? Michael is in West Virginia. Hello, Michael.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
It's cool to go. It's cool to come into Sinatra. I thought that was nice.
Yeah, I like that song.
Yeah, I've got a question for you. How often are you ever on YouTube?
Not that often. Somebody will send me something, and I'll go take a look at it. Yeah.
Well, okay. I saw this video, and it only goes to show you the sense of madness I think we're really going down into.
Yeah.
There's a gentleman that's on here. The name of the video is called Facebook Parroting for the Troubled Teen.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be mentioning this to you if it had only 400 hits.
Right.
But it don't, or 20, or 400 views, but it has over 22 million views.
22 million?
Yes, sir. And of the 22 million views, over 200,000 of them are likes, and only 21,000 dislikes.
Right.
And there's this gentleman who's just sitting there, and he's reading a Facebook comment that his daughter left for him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's being really disrespectful towards him and everything. And he's just sitting there. He's got his cowboy hat on and his loose fitting Wranglers. And, you know, he's just sitting here in a wooden chair.
Is this the one where the guy shoots it?
Yes.
Right. Yeah. I didn't see it. I didn't see the YouTube, but I saw it on, I think, one of the early morning talk television programs, one of the networks or one of the cables. Yeah, I saw the part where he puts about six rounds into the laptop. I don't know what the hell that was about. I didn't think it was funny or not funny. I just thought, what the hell is going on? I guess like you, what the hell is going on?
Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, all that because he your daughter disrespected you. Have you not heard of teenage rebellion?
Well, according to the Bible, though, according to Leviticus, he should have put the rounds in his daughter. I mean, that's what it says to do. You know, the same part about a man not lying with a man as he would lie with a woman, and not very far from that it says, and if you, one of your children disrespect you, kill them. It's a great book, Leviticus.
I don't know. If he would have done that, then, you know, it would have been the same as that that judge down in Texas that that took the belt to his daughter. But it got all these likes, and everybody's, you know, saying, you know, he deserves a medal and all that.
I know.
The only comment that I could say was, why didn't you just take the computer away, you know, confiscate it?
Yeah. Well, he doesn't, you know, what he needs to be is ignored. Just totally ignored. That kind of childish, even though it's a handgun and it's loaded, but oh my God. Hey, Michael, thanks, man. I appreciate you checking in. All right, take care. Gary, is this Gary? No, that's not Gary. Where's Gary?
No, it isn't.
Oh, there's Gary. Hey, Gary.
Hey, how you doing, Mike?
I'm all right. You're in Toledo, right? Homeboy, what's up?
Well, I live in Toledo, but right now I'm a semi-driver and I'm on the road headed to Philadelphia.
Oh, man, I thought you were calling from Toledo. All right, that's all right, but that's okay.
Well, if you want to talk about Toledo, I know about it.
No,
you know?
I don't want to talk about it. I'm sorry, man. What you got on your mind?
I just wanted to say this.
Yeah.
All the people that complain about the people who try to protect the environment, mm-hmm. might be the same clowns that like going camping. They love putting their nice boats out on the water,
right,
without debris hitting them. They love going skiing. I mean, they love doing all the recreational things when the weather is nice.
Right.
But they're the main ones that's out here complaining and bitching all the time.
That's
about
right.
People who will want to try to protect the environment.
Yeah, I know. It doesn't make any sense to me. Don't try to find any sense in it, Gary. You'll go crazy.
Hey, I like that Marvin Gaye cut that you played.
Yeah, we're playing that.
He's got a couple of tunes on there that talks about the environment.
That's
and
right.
That was back in 1970.
That's right. That's right. I mean, it was a long time. You really listen to the lyrics on this album or this CD.
Oh, yeah.
And you hear Marvin Gaye singing about the destruction to the environment, how children are being abused. You know,
yes.
a lot of folks listen to this music and they get into the, you know, kind of the mellowness of it, and they're not really aware of what the hell the man was saying.
And I try to teach my kids. I've got my kids to start listening to old school music.
Mm-hmm.
I said, because there's so much that they said back in the day that's going on today.
Yeah, that's so
you
true.
You know, a lot of things. And the music of today, I just can't get into it. Like, I'm old school, you know.
Oh, yeah, me too. I just we'll have to talk about this sometime, Gary. There's the music. I got to go. Drive safely, okay?
Okay, buddy. Thank you.
All right. Take care, Gary. Take care. Call me sometime when you're in Toledo, pal. We'll talk about Toledo. All right. When we come back, 10 steps toward radical revolution in the United States of America. You got the guts to stick around for that? Welcome back. It is 7 past the hour. You know, like I mentioned earlier, a lot of times people who listen to this program say, well, you know, you bitch and complain a lot, but where's the solutions? I guess the cynic can make an argument that solutions are very hard to come by when things get this screwed up. But there have been positions in human history, times in human history before where things look terribly unfixable, right? Somehow we came through. I don't know if that still applies. The past is not always a predictor of the future, right? But anyway, in thinking about solutions, rather than just bitching about the problems, I came across something written by Bill Quigley at Counterpunch about a month ago, I guess. And, you know, have been reading it and thinking about it, and come to the conclusion that Quigley is probably offering about the only way out of this mess. He is the legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. He's also a law professor at Loyola University in New Orleans. But he has 10 steps toward radical revolution in the U.S. of A. And he quotes Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who, you know, 45 years ago said, quote, "I'm convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values." Now, as is true with a lot of things that Dr. King said, you have to think about that statement. And that's beyond the ability of right-wingers. Christian conservatives, the extreme right, that sentence is just gibberish. Or, since it has the word revolution in it, it's probably something to do with communists or hippies or homosexuals or liberals. You know what I mean. But Quigley has some interesting points. He says, number one, human rights must be taken absolutely seriously, which we don't do in this country. Nobody does anywhere on earth. He says, every single person is entitled to dignity and human rights. No application needed, no exclusions at all. This is our highest priority. Now, isn't that true? I mean, aren't the right-wingers always blabbering and frothing in the mouth about the dignity and the sanctity of every individual person, yet they have no problem in the slaughtering of individual persons. They have no problem in the dehumanizing of individual persons. You know, once again, it's a hypocrisy. So, number one, human rights. Number two, we have to radically reinvent contemporary democracy. Ta-da! In a political sense, that would probably be number one. But Quigley is giving an overview of 10 steps toward radical revolution. So we must radically reinvent contemporary democracy as step number two. Current systems are deeply corrupt, he writes, and not responsive to the needs of people. Absolutely. Representatives, Quigley writes, chosen by money and influence, govern by money and influence. Or as Molly Ivan so famously said one time, you got to dance with the one that brung you. Right? Direct democracy, Quigley goes on, by the people is now technologically possible and should be the rule. Communities must be protected whenever they advocate for self-determination, self-development, and human rights. Dissent is essential to democracy, we pledge to help it flourish. Now, that last bit, dissent is essential to democracy. That's why there's such a crackdown on dissent, is because the trend in this country, as it has been for the past 80 or 90 years, serious trend, is toward fascism. It's incremental. It's slow. It's two steps forward, one step back, but it's been moving forward nonetheless. So dissent, which is essential to democracy, is being smashed into the ground. You can go back to the 60s and see the the modern reaction to dissent. I realize that in the 20s and the 30s and before the turn of the 20th century, there was dissent in this country. But the dissent now has become almost exclusively political. And the reaction has been suppression, not listening to the dissent, not a listening to the dissenting claims, not an acknowledging that things are wrong, rather suppression. First Amendment zones my ass. I mean, come on. Number three, corporations are not people, and they are not entitled to human rights. Wow, really? But, anyway, Quigley goes on, amend the U.S. Constitution so it is clear that corporations do not have constitutional or human rights. We the people must cut them down to size, and so democracy can regulate their size, scope, and actions. Now, the fly in the ointment there is amend the U.S. Constitution. Amending the Constitution, as you know, takes a massive majority in not just the legislative branch of the U.S. U.S. government, but also majorities in a majority of the states of the Union. So, since corporate America or capitalist America has bought in its entirety the political system, that one, number three, is going to be difficult. Corporations are not people, not entitled to human rights, so amend the Constitution to clearly state that. That's a toughie. Number four, leave the rest of the world alone. Now, remember, what Quigley's coming up with here is 10 steps toward radical revolution in the United States. It would be almost impossible for capitalism to leave, the American capitalism, to leave the rest of the world alone. How do you do that? But he goes on, cut U.S. military spending by 75%, bring all the troops outside the U.S. home now. Defense of the United States is a human right. Global offense and global police force by U.S. military are not global human rights. He goes on to say, eliminate all nuclear and chemical and biological weapons. Stop allowing scare tactics to build up the national security forces at home. Stop the myth that the U.S. is somehow special or exceptional and is entitled to act differently from all the other nations. The U.S. must rejoin the global family of nations as a respectful partner. The United States is one of many nations in the world. We must start acting like it. That also is going to be a real tough one, right, Mr. Quigley? And that's simply because we have had generation upon generation upon generation pounded into the skulls of those successive generations American exceptionalism, which is dog snot. Anyone with any kind of an historical sense would understand that there is not such a thing as American exceptionalism, unless you want to say that the ability to migrate to this country and immediately start exploiting your neighbors through the capitalist system, okay, I guess that would make us unique. That would be exceptionalism. But that's not something you really want to write home to mom about. That's not something that you are proud of, are you? Yeah, I guess you are proud of it. Okay, so those are the first four. Human rights, invent democracy, corporations are not people, and leave the rest of the world alone. There's some more here. Stick around. You got to hear these. I'm Mike Malloy. Money and drag us down the road to heaven. I am a patriot. I am a patriot. I am a patriot. I am a patriot. Yes, I am.
Country that's safe, in a land that's clean and free, for every color and culture, every person, every belief. Your greed, your fear, and your lies ain't gonna push me around. I'm gonna use the power I have. I'm gonna vote you right out of that house, 'cause I am a patriot.
Uh-oh, he just had another cup of coffee. Here's Mike Malloy.
Past the hour. Bill Quigley, writing Counterpunch about a month ago, 10 steps toward radical revolution in the United States. Number one, human rights. Number two, reinvent contemporary democracy. Number three, corporations are not people. Number four, leave the rest of the world alone. Number five, property rights, privilege, and money-making are not as important as human rights. Uh-oh. Really? Quigley's absolutely right, of course. He says, when current property and privilege arrangements are not just, they must yield to the demands of human rights. Money-making can only be allowed when human rights are respected. Exploitation is unacceptable. This is a lot more idealistic than you thought it would be, right, Truth Seeker? But that's why it's called radical revolution. Quickly goes on, there are national and global poverty lines. We must establish national and global excess lines so that people and businesses with extra houses, extra cars, extra luxuries, extra income share much more to help everyone else be able to exercise their basic human rights to shelter, food, education, and health care. If that disrupts current property privilege and money making, so be it. Ooh. I mean, what an idea that there are limits. Since we have lines under which we define poverty and act accordingly, or are supposed to when those lines are breached, then should there not also be lines that identify excess greed and wealth? I mean, how many houses does one family need? And you know, some people answer, well, as many as they can afford. No, that's not true. The exploitation of natural resources, the exploitation of human resources in order to satisfy the upper 1/100th, the 1%, so these thugs can own 20 houses and 80 cars and 6 jetliners to do what? Is that class envy? No, it's common sense. To have anyone in the human tribe with that kind of luxury and wealth is ridiculous, especially because it can only be gotten to that point through exploitation, denial of another person's rights. You show me a massive fortune, and I will show you at some point in the acquisition of that fortune, horrendous fraud, crimes, maybe murder. That's just the way it goes. You know it as well as I do. Number six, defend the earth. Defend the earth. Stop pollution. Stop pipelines. Stop new interstate highways. Stop destroying the land, sea, and air by extracting resources from them. Rebuild what we have destroyed. If corporations, or he says corporations, I would say capitalism, if corporations will not stop voluntarily, people must stop them. The very existence of life is at stake. Defend the earth. Defend the earth. The very existence of life is at stake. How many people think about that during the day? Do you ever think about that during the day? You're going about your business? I have to say occasionally I do, but maybe it's only because I dig around in the pile of stories and articles and comments and commentary and opinion to try to find material for this program. So, you know, I get exposed to it, but in a normal everyday life, no, I don't think about the very existence of life on this planet is at stake. I may think about, you know, Molly's dance class this afternoon, or Molly's brownie meeting next Thursday, or, you know, stuff like that. Or whether or not when school's over today, will she, on Wednesday, she has Spanish immersion. In other words, for someone like me and possibly like you, if you have small children or nieces and nephews, you're thinking about that. But to think about that and not realize that the very existence of life on Earth is at stake is kind of stupid on my part and yours. Because, you know, Molly can attend all the dance classes and brownie lessons that we can cram into her. But if she reaches the age of 30 and doesn't have a livable environment, what good will it have done? You understand what I'm saying? Right? Defend the earth. And as Quigley puts it, defend our earth. Number seven, dramatically expand public spaces and reverse the privatization of public services. He says quality public education, health, and safety for all must be provided by transparent, accountable public systems. Starving the state, which is what the right-wingers want to do, that's a recipe for destroying social and economic human rights for everyone but the rich. And that's the reason destroy the state, destroy public systems is the current vogue. We'll be right back.
You don't have to pay the lad. You better thank God for that. There's hope. It doesn't cost a thing to smile. You don't have to pay the lad. You better thank God for that. There's hope. Every time I turn on the TV, there's hope. Somebody's acting crazy. There's hope. You let it, it'll drive you crazy. There's hope. But I'm taking back my power today.
The Mike Malloy Show, because each time you listen to right-wing radio, God kills a kitten.
Before the hour. All right, what we're doing here, is solutions to what we're dealing with right now, not just in the United States but globally. And this is kind of a counterpoint to the points that we make nightly on this program about what's wrong and how things continue to spiral out of control. Even though it seems to be that spiraling out of control seems to be something that most people are just willing to float into denial about and avoidance. And, you know, okay. But Bill Quigley, writing in Counterpunch about a month ago, 10 Steps Toward Radical Revolution in the United States, and he starts with a quote from Dr. King, from 42 years ago, or 42, yeah, 42 years ago. I'm convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. So, Quigley has 10 of them. One, human rights. Two, radically reinvent democracy. By human rights, they must be taken absolutely seriously. Three, corporations are not people. Get a constitutional amendment to state that categorically for once and for all. Four, leave the rest of the world alone. Number five, making sure that exploitation, the end result being property rights and privilege and money making, the exploitation of that sort is not acceptable. Six, defend the earth. Seven, expand public spaces and reverse the privatization of public services. As Quigley says, starving the state, which is what the right-wingers and corporate America, capitalist America, is determined to do, starving the state is a recipe for destroying social and economic human rights for everyone but the rich. And that's why they're doing it. Number eight, put the criminal legal prison system, or pull it up and out by its roots and start over. Cease the criminalization of drugs, of immigrants, of poor people, people of color. We are entitled to be safe, Quigley writes, but the current system makes us less safe and ruins millions of lives. Start over. You know, the criminal justice system used to be a rehabilitative idea. What is it today? It's another aspect of capitalism. The prison industrial complex. Corporatism has taken over, or is getting close to taking over, the prison systems across the country. And do you think the corporations that take over the prisons are interested in turning out citizens when people complete their sentence? Do you think that the goal of CCA or whatever the hell they are, some of these companies that run prisons, do you think the goal is to make sure that at the end of a prison sentence, and don't forget, something like 85 to 90% of people who go into prison eventually come out, do you think the goal is to make sure that they come out as productive citizens, or is the goal simply to extract the money from the taxpayers, lock people up, provide a minimum where it concerns service? Food, a toilet, a cot. As far as rehabilitative services or job training or education, why coddle prisoners, right? Isn't that the right-wing attitude? So, rip it up. Start over. End the prison industrial complex. See, these are not, what Quigley has come up with here is an extremely difficult list. Extremely difficult. But let us proceed. We're at number 9. The U.S. was created, Quigley writes, based on two original crimes that must be confessed and made right. Geez, how many times have we talked about this, right? Reparations are owed to Native Americans because their land was stolen, they were uprooted and slaughtered. Reparations are owed to African Americans because they were kidnapped, enslaved, and abused. The United States has profited widely from these injustices and must make amends. You know, I can only guess at how many family fortunes that are still in existence. As a matter of fact, that have triple, quadruple, quintupled, septupled, sextupled. It's just gotten larger and larger based on original theft of land, original exploitation of labor, the theft of land from the people who were actually here first, and the exploitation of labor, of course, from slaves that were imported to do the work until they dropped dead. So, as we've talked about on this program many times, you know, before the idea of reparations can be handled, there has to be a multi-generational effort to educate young Americans, especially native-born Americans, no matter where their parents or grandparents came from. Educate Americans as to how this country got started. You know, every time I mention that, slavery and genocide, you know, I just hear deafening silence. You know, I'm imagining here, I hear deafening silence on this program all the time. But you know what I'm saying? I mean, that who wants to face that? And I've also talked about what they did in South Africa at the end of apartheid. Reconciliation Commission, where an attempt was made for the two races to confront each other, and whatever confessions were necessary, the white Afrikaners had tremendous a number of confessions to make. Black South Africans had a few of their own. But a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the key being the first word, truth. Truth, truth, truth. I look at, you know, I've had several children. I have one now in second grade. I have grandchildren. And over the years, over the decades, I have watched and paid very close attention to, obviously, to what they were learning in school when it got into social studies. Math is math. Science is science. Foreign language is foreign language. But aha, social, English is English, but social studies. What are they learning? How is American history taught? Whether it is the application of American power here or abroad. You know, American history. not just here, but all over the place. How's it being taught? And then I compare it to how I was taught. And it occurs to me that half a century after I got an elementary education, my 7-year-old is getting essentially the same education. In other words, she's still being told, or she's being told, the same lies I was told half a century ago. Now, it's up to me and her mother to temper those lies with as much truth as we think she can handle, just like it's up to you if you have children or grandchildren or nieces or nephews. It's up to you. So when Quigley talks about confronting the two original crimes on which this country was founded, he's not kidding. I mean, how can you have forward progress that includes everybody if you don't have the courage to confront your past? Truth and reconciliation is what's needed here. I frankly think that, you know, Quigley's 10 ideas here are wonderful. They're very idealistic. But that one, truth and reconciliation, how would you teach American children without a national nervous breakdown? How would you teach them about the atrocities? How would you explain to them how the Gatling gun was used by American Marines in the Philippine Civil War, which came as an outgrowth of the Spanish-American War, that the Gatling gun was used on entire villages of people that would make the My Lai incidents that we perpetrated in Vietnam seem like a Sunday school picnic? That United States Marines would order entire villages into the craters of dead volcanoes, and then line the rim of the volcano with soldiers, Marines, with as many Gatling guns as they could get up to the top of this extinct volcano. And then the order to fire was given, and hundreds, thousands of people, men, women, and children, cut to pieces. I mean, how do you teach that? How do you teach that the person who reported that originally was Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens, writing for, I believe, the Baltimore newspaper as a war correspondent? How do you go from Huckleberry Finn and Mark Twain, or Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer, to Mark Twain writing about U.S. atrocities in the Spanish-American War in the Philippines? How do you do that? How do you explain to children what the Reagan administration did in Central America? So Quigley's idea of confronting the truth, well, I'm reminded of that line in A Few Good Men: you can't handle the truth.
Cleaning up America one flying monkey at a time. Here's Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. So, we're almost there now. Bill Quigley writing a counterpunch about a month ago, 10 steps toward radical revolution in the United States. This comes under the heading of the Boy Program as solution, because usually what we do on this program is point out the horrific shortcomings, flaws, and apparent dead ends that we're involved in now, both politically and economically. So Quigley had 10 steps toward radical revolution in the United States, which is what it's going to take. Anyone who now thinks that holding committee meetings or sitting down quietly protesting is going to have an effect is wrong, unless the number of people sitting down quietly protesting gets into the tens of millions. On the day when that happens in the United States, as it has happened in relative numbers in other countries, On the day that that happens, the government, the corporate government of the United States, will take notice. And not until 300,000 people in the streets in Washington, D.C., will hardly get a notice on the nightly news. 30 million in the streets all around the country will bring this country to an absolute standstill until we can move forward again rationally. So, number 10. Everyone who wants to work should have the right to work and earn a living wage. Any worker who wants to organize and advocate for change in solidarity with others must be absolutely protected from recriminations from their employer and from their government. That's number 10. The right to work. Now, you notice what Quigley's talking about here. The right-wingers, the Romneys and the Santorums and the rest of these evil sons of bitches that are stalking the political system right now. And the way they talk about Obama, Obama has the doesn't want a society that works. Obama wants a society that sits on its ass and gets a welfare check. Aren't you tired of hearing that, Truth Seeker? I mean, that's Reagan talk. From 1979. Why are we still listening to these halfwits? And, well, better yet, or worse yet, why are they still saying it? They're saying it because there is still an enormous number of Americans who want to believe that. Oh, yeah, the welfare queens. Just like there's an enormous number of Americans who want to believe that one of the biggest drains on the federal budget is foreign aid. And it only accounts for, what, about 2%, if that? Not even that, I don't think. I mean, when you remove Colombia, Egypt, if we're still giving money to Egypt, and Israel, when you take those three countries out, you've just taken out about 90% of what we call foreign aid. 80%? What is it, Prairie 2? Quigley says, finally, if those in government and those in power do not help the people do what is right, then people seeking change have got to come together, exercise our human rights, and bring about these changes directly. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and millions of others lived and worked for a radical revolution of values. We will as well, Quigley writes. We respect the human rights and human dignity of others and work for a world where love and wisdom and solidarity and respect prevail. We expect those for whom the current unjust system works just fine will object and oppose and accuse people seeking dramatic change of being divisive and worse. You've heard it. Class warfare, class warfare, class warfare. Right? As Quigley concludes, that is to be expected because this is what happens to all groups which work for serious social change. Despite that, people will continue to go forward with determination and purpose to bring about a radical revolution of values in the United States of America. Bill Quigley writing at Counterpunch about a month ago. Well, yeah, people will continue to do that, Bill, until such time as the force of repression in this country becomes so all-pervasive, so all-powerful, that it becomes an impossibility. Human rights must be taken seriously. We must radically reinvent contemporary democracy. We must amend the Constitution so that it is clear that corporations do not have constitutional or human rights. We have got to leave the rest of the world alone. We've got to acknowledge that human rights are far more important than property rights privilege of the upper 0.1% and money rights. We must defend the planet. We must expand public spaces. We've got to have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission or a reasonable facsimile thereof in order to confront the foundation of this country and how it was put together and why. And number 10, anyone who wants to work should have the right to work and the right to organize. Radical revolution in the United States. There you have it. You notice there's no mention of guns, bullets, bombs, napalm, white phosphorus, poison gas, pepper spray, incarceration, plastic handcuffs. Not a bit. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.